This is Starves for Recipes, episode 120. Welcome to Startups for Recipes, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Rob?
I got a call Sunday night from one of my developers. We almost never speak on the phone. Picked up the phone and I said, uh-oh, and it's Sunday night about 7 p.m. And he says, do we have a backup of the database?
Oh, no.
I was like, yeah, what happened? And as he's talking, I said, you forgot the where clause. He forgot a where clause on an update statement.
Oh,
I've done this twice in 12 years where you say update the table, set this column equals that. And, you know, for those non-developers out there, then you're supposed to say where the ID, customer ID, equals 123. So you only update one row. But if you leave that where clause off, you update the entire table, every row, to the same value. And so if you only have 50 rows, that's fine. If you have 5 million rows, they all get updated. Now, it turns out it was a small table. It was 4,000 rows. And luckily enough, it was not a table that's used in real time. So it was something that's used in billing process. So I was able to we stopped the billing process. I was going to run a few hours later. And then I got in touch with our DBA. And that's one of the benefits of having a DBA is he has all that. I've asked him just to have up to the minute backups. And so he could basically restore to a point in time. So I said, restore it to like 7:15 p.m. Pacific time, you know, because he ran the query at 7:20. He's on UK time, so it did take a couple hours because I didn't want to wake him in the middle of the night for something that wasn't taking down the app. But once he got the message, it was like 20 minutes later, everything was restored, and it was fine.
Yeah, I've done that in the past at least once or twice myself, and I've learned if I have an update statement that I've written, what I'll usually do is I'll comment out just like the update part of it, and I'll do a select first to make sure that I'm selecting all the rows that I actually want to update.
I've seen professional like DBA, you know, 24/7 DBA guys do that. And that's what I do now too. Like I said, I've done this twice. And the first time I did it was through an Oracle database and it has the rollback capability because you have to commit. And so I saved myself with the rollback. The second time I did it, there was a way to reconstruct the data. And I just had to spend about an hour doing some manual stuff. And realistically, as we talked through, there's only, you know, myself and these two other people with production database access. So as we talked it through, there were ways, you know, if we didn't have a backup or the backups had failed or something, there was a way to manually reconstruct this data that would have been a pain. We would have had to pull it from a couple of different sources, but it was like all was not lost. And realistically, the app, you know, wouldn't have been sunk. So, but it was it's such a funny quote, you know, do we have a backup of the database?
Yeah, those are words that you just never want to hear. Did you put that out on Twitter? Because that would have been a great quote.
What's been going on last week?
Been doing some more work on Audit Shark with the self-updating policy builder, and that is finally working. It's taken forever to get it working, but it got to the point where we had to read through the source code, or I didn't read through the source code, my developer did, in order to get the installer working, because we were using the Wix toolset, which is open source, but it's not documented real well. So he had to resort at one point to just reading through the source code to figure out what different pieces did and how to make it work and do what we wanted to. So at this point, everything seems to be working. You can just install it, and then every time you run it, it double checks to verify that you have the latest version. If you don't have the latest version, it just doesn't self-update, which is pretty awesome. It seems to work even if you have like UAC running. It just asks you if you're okay with updating it, and it'll just go through and update it, and everything seems to be working pretty flawlessly.
Nice. And this was a little bit of a hang-up for your early access.
Yeah, it put the whole early access on hold for much longer than I would have liked. I mean, it didn't seem like this should have taken as long as it did, but because of all the issues that we ran into with it, I'm not real happy about where the early access is right now. So I feel like I'm behind schedule on a lot of it, and I haven't talked to nearly enough customers to understand what's really important to them so far. So I'm really considering just kind of extending the early access to get more of that feedback and bring more people onto it, because that was really just holding me up. And until that was done, I couldn't really add more people to it.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think you need to get more feedback from more people. Because it doesn't sound like you've talked to enough, at least when we've talked on the podcast. It sounds like you have a few people who've given you feedback, but not enough that you've made like drastic changes if needed. I mean, in the interest of accountability, like the original early access was supposed to start September 10th, I think, and you started it and then there was something wrong and I think you spent about 6 weeks fixing it. And then I don't remember what happened in October, November, but I don't remember if the holidays got in the way or what. But so you're now, you know, you're several months into essentially early access. You kind of started one and then stopped it and then restarted again in January. Do you have a tight time frame for this one for like extending it, or what are your thoughts at this point?
I wouldn't extend it by more than a couple of weeks, I don't think, and not unless something drastically serious comes up where people are trying to use it and it outright doesn't work. The other question is whether I release it without the full-blown Linux support, which I probably would. I would probably just launch it, and there are pieces that my developer has built in which allow me to turn on and turn off different functions based on whether flags are set on their account. So I can say, okay, we'll turn Linux support on for this account and not that one, for example, which is kind of a neat function to have. So I'll probably just kind of plow forward without having full-blown Linux support in there, and you know, with the on the Windows side, just, you know, move forward with what I got. But I'd really like to get some more feedback from people as to what they think of how it operates, what sort of reports they want, things like that. So I don't think that I would extend it by more than probably 3 weeks or so, but I do want to get some more people signed on to it and get some feedback from them.
So coming back to that drip landing page split test I was running last week, if you recall, I had a kind of a stripped down minimalist version, and then I had a heavily designed drop shadow, what's going to be the final marketing version, and they're split tested against each other. And so far, the minimalist version is just trouncing, absolutely trouncing. I think it has 500% more conversions, the highly designed version, which almost makes me, that's such a big difference that it makes me think there might, like, either someone is messing with me because they know that I'm doing this, or there's like a cookie issue, because I was running a split test right before this one and there's somehow the cookies have overlapped or something. So I think I'm going to like totally restart it and see if I get the same results. If I do, then I need to seriously look at like what to do in terms of the marketing site, because I don't just want to turn on a design that's not converting.
I might go ahead and put either InspectLit or Crazy Egg on there just to see where people are actually going through and measuring it for a couple of days to see what people are doing when they get there.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Actually, InspectLit, where it records the mouse movement, that would be a really good one.
Cool. So what else have you got going on?
Last thing I've been working on is, over the past week, I've migrated about 5 more sites to WP Engine. And, you know, DreamHost was, man, I've been on there since 2005. And for the first probably 5 or 6 years, they were solid. I mean, they were really just a great value for the money. I always knew they weren't a high-end host, but they have just had, at least with my server, I'm on a really old server now, right? Because I'm 8 years old. And it's just, stuff is getting slower and slower and slower, and I'm needing to pay more money because I'm on a VPS and I have to crank up all the usage, the bandwidth and stuff. There's no sites I even have left on DreamHost now that are using many resources. They're just not high-volume sites. The only thing I can think of, actually, is our podcast episodes are on there. Like the actual MP3s. And I know that it's like, what is it, a terabyte or something a month?
Yeah, something like that.
Like a terabyte a month of download. But geez, it should be able to handle that, you know? You know, as a result of all this, the MicroConf site is now stable. It's up on WP Engine. It had 2 outages within a week. Knock on wood, shouldn't have that again, because WP Engine is a much, much more stable and faster environment. And then I also got several blogs and some other kind of more critical sites. I think now all of my really critical sites are off of DreamHost on WP Engine.
Yeah, I still have to move over the podcast site. I haven't quite done that yet.
Yeah, and then once you do that, we'll need to think about moving the actual audio, the MP3 files as well, because they're on my DreamHost account.
Cool. Today we're going to be talking about how to bring people into your business so that your business can move to the next level. Because obviously it's extremely difficult to do everything yourself. You need to bring people in who you can plug into different areas of your business. And depending on what level your business is at and what you need done is going to kind of dictate the types of people that you bring in. So I thought today we'd talk about the different types of people that you can bring into your business, what sort of roles they would play, when is it appropriate to bring them in, when is it not appropriate, how to find these people, and what they can do for you that either you can't or shouldn't, or that other people couldn't or shouldn't do for you.
Right. And there's some people probably listening right now that are thinking, I don't want to bring anyone on. I want to stay the solo founder that I am right now, the solopreneur, and I don't want to hire people because I don't want the responsibility. And obviously that's a perfectly legitimate point of view. And both you and I have done that or are doing that presently. Even if you're doing that though, there's still a couple of these roles, like we're going to talk about advisors and virtual assistants, that I would encourage you to think about doing, because I've stopped believing that you really can do it really well all on your own. You can get halfway there, you can get most of the way there, but if you want to achieve your full potential, I'll say, or you want to grow faster, or you just want some guidance and support, there are some of these roles, even if you're not going to hire an employee, you're not going to hire someone a full-time or a part-time on a regular basis, there's still help that you can and should bring in to outsource certain tasks. And there's still those roles of like advisors or mastermind fellows that I think are critical, even if you truly do want to stay that solopreneur.
So the first one we're going to talk about today is an intern. I think that when you're talking about an intern, you can do either a paid internship or an unpaid internship. But at the end of the day, I mean, you're still talking about somebody who's essentially a entry-level employee. I think the real drawback to interns is that because they are low-level, because you have to spend a lot of time training them, it may not necessarily be worth your time because of all the extra time that you have to spend doing that training. And training is very time-intensive. It's very mentally intensive to make sure that you're on top of what they're doing and making sure that they're doing the right things. Because if they're doing the wrong things, then not only are you spending that time with them trying to train them, but then you have to go back and you have to still do the work anyway. And whether that's having them redo it or correct them, you're going to basically sink a lot more of your time than you would if they just did it right the first time, or if you paid somebody who was much more skilled or experienced to do that work.
Yeah, I think defining interns as someone who's entry level but has an interest in learning about the field, I think is probably a pretty good way to define it. And I've always been hesitant to hire an intern. I'd say over the past 3 years, I've averaged 2 requests per summer, college students or grad students who are in like digital marketing or, you know, majoring in something dealing with online marketing, who have emailed me and wanted to intern. And I've really struggled with the decision. And every time I get the email, because the person A is taking initiative, and so I know that they're probably going to be someone who gets things done, and B, it's just, I just like to help people out. I like to give back and teach. I have decided not to do it after a lot of thinking and talking to people. The other thing is I almost feel like if someone's going to come and work for free or work for a really, really low stipend, which is typical, I think all the ones who have offered have said they'd work for free. It just kind of, it doesn't seem right to me. Like it seems like I'm getting something. I know they're getting training, but it's like if I'm trying to do it to save money, but I'm just having to invest a bunch of time, then that equation doesn't work for me, you know, because my time is, I value my time really highly. And so I'd almost rather find someone who is already experienced and pay them like a fair wage for their time and probably have more time for my business and then give back to the entrepreneurial community through these other avenues. So, but I do know people who've hired interns and have had great success doing it. I know founders who've done it. I know that Dan Andrews has his Tropical MBA program where those people tend to have a little more experience than what we're talking about, but the cost is not very high and they do come in with the attitude of learning. So I know that it can definitely work. It's just not something that, you know, has worked for me personally in the past. I've opted for one of these other roles that we're going to talk about.
Right. I think that the situation where interns would actually work really well is if you're trying to grow your business and you are looking at your intern program as if it's a method of bringing people out of college and vetting them before you hire them, because you're going to get a lot better view of what somebody's like as an employee when they're an intern than you will in like a 45-minute or a 3-hour interview. I mean, you just get a much better idea of how somebody works working next to them or having them report to you for 2, 3, 4 months than you do in just going through the regular interview process, because there's a world of difference between those two things. So the next one we're going to talk about is a virtual assistant.
I'm actually down to 3 virtual assistants right now. I don't include developers, designers, product managers, any of those technical roles in the virtual assistant bucket. But I have 3 who are working for me, down from, I think at my peak, I had 6. I've hired about 15 over the past probably 4 or 5 years, and some have just not worked out, and then others have had to move on. Like one went to grad school and so couldn't do VA stuff anymore. And then others I've, you know, decided to let go or just kind of wound down the projects they were working on. But I've always found a lot of value in finding someone. I mean, the nice part about a VA is you can typically find someone who has experience in the area that you need help with, right? So you have someone who's already trained. Now, they may not be a highly technical person or a highly, a design-oriented person, but you don't hire them for that kind of stuff. You hire them for admin work and research and responding to emails and other tasks that are just hard to get done. And you kind of just need a jack of many trades, like a non-technical jack of many trades. I am putting out a video course on how and why to hire VAs if you have a startup. And if you're interested in that, you can go to softwarebyrob.com and there's an email newsletter sign up in the upper right. And that's where I'll be mentioning that.
I think the biggest advantage that I've found with virtual assistants is using them to, as more of a human filter, to whittle down vast quantities of information into something that's consumable. So I've used VAs to go out and search for like themes, for example. If I'm putting together a WordPress site and I need a theme for the WordPress site, I'll point to several of them and say, these are kind of what I'm looking for. Find me 10 or 12 other options that are close to this one, because that's something that you can't have a computer do it. And even if you could, it would take forever to build a program that would actually go out and be able to do that for you. So having a human sit there and look through those and use their brain to kind of figure out what it is that you're actually looking for and then present you with those options is a great way to use a virtual assistant to cut down on the amount of time that you're spending on something. And that way you're going through a pre-filtered list as opposed to searching through tens of thousands of themes that are out there.
Yeah, that's a really good example. Ways that I've used a VA in the past couple months have included, you know, we have people cancel Hittail, right, and during the trial, and then we have some customers cancel. And I wanted to email all of those over a certain period of time and say, why did you cancel? You know, because they either didn't give us a reason or didn't give us a full enough reason in the cancellation form. And I wanted it to be personal and come from someone on the team. And I also wanted someone to just be able to hit reply when they get the email and send it back to us. So yes, I could write a script to send a bunch of emails, you know, but it's like by the time I do that, I had a Google Doc spreadsheet that I sent to the VA and I just said, can you email them all? And here's the form. It's short. All they have to do is hit reply. And then he gathered up those responses, put them in Google Docs, and he actually arranged them. He didn't just spit them in there as a big chunk of data. He actually said, you know, three people said this similar thing. And so it's like you said, he took a large volume of manual information and did something that it wouldn't have been easy to write a computer to sift through all the responses. And we would have gotten less responses if sent them to a form instead of just saying, please reply. And just let us know in one sentence, you know, why you responded. So that was super helpful. And actually, that's where we did operation retention based on all of those responses. And that's how I do. I view virtual assistants as a form of human automation. It's a way to automate things that you may down the line want to do in code or that may be just a little too hard to do with software, but that having someone's help can just help save you as a founder so much time, hopefully on a recurring basis. Those are the ones you should attack first, or for these one-time projects like you and I have just mentioned.
The other thing is it's faster to write down a process and hand it to a virtual assistant and have them go through it than it is to code up any sort of computer program to go through it automatically. And although it may be less expensive in the long run to do that, depending on what the actions are, you're going to get somebody sitting there and looking at those things, and you're going to be able to hand them this process. They're going to be able to execute it within 5 minutes after you hand it to them, as opposed to a computer program, which might take you weeks or even months to put together.
Right. And, you know, a founder friend of mine who has a successful SaaS app, he was still answering emails, like all the support emails. He was doing tier one email support up until it was probably 3-4 months ago. He said it wasn't taking him enough time per week that he didn't think it was justified to hire a VA to help him out with tier one support. Now, once he did, he was just like, I cannot believe I didn't do this sooner, you know, because it's not about the sheer volume. It's like, oh, it's only 3 hours a week, but it's all the little interruptions that you get along the way. And it's having the weight of those sitting in a queue somewhere that you have to come back to 5-6 days a week, you know, several different trigger points during the day you want to check in because you don't want it to be 24 hours before someone hears back. And if you can just get someone on board to help out with you, even if they are only spending a few hours a week to start, it's invaluable towards removing that mental burden.
So the next one is a contractor. And I think that both of you and I put contractors in basically the same boat, where contractors are a technical step up from a virtual assistant. So whether they're doing video editing, audio editing, software development, design work, copywriting, those kinds of things, that's generally the role that a contractor fills for you. And I think the differentiation between a contractor and a consultant, which is the next thing we'll talk about, is that a contractor is somebody who's coming in on an hourly basis, and you put together an idea of what it is that they're going to be working on. And if you need them for 1 hour a week or, you know, 25 hours a week, they're going to come in and they're going to do that work for you. But the expectation is that it's more on demand than anything else. The difference between a contractor and a consultant is that a consultant tends to come in as a highly specialized person in one specific thing. And I differentiate between contractors and consultants because consultants come in for a very short period of time. You have a very specific problem that you want solved, and they tend to be much more expensive. Now, you might hire a contractor to come in and do some graphic design work or design some email templates. And I kind of put that person into a contractor role, even though it is a short-term gig, but the fact is that they're much less expensive. Whereas if I wanted to hire a high-end SEO consultant or a high-end SEO contractor, the idea is that the person is there only for a short period of time, and the value that they're going to be delivering is extremely high to you, and that is why you're paying them, you know, these vast quantities of money, as opposed to a contractor who is still providing value to you, but it's not necessarily the same level as a consultant comes in.
I think the point at which you start to think about bringing contractors or consultants on are if you have a little bit of money, and if you have, you know, either from your day job, if you're bootstrapping, or from the product revenue perspective, if you're actually launched already. That's the thing with contractors and consultants is they're more expensive than virtual assistants and interns, but they free up your time. Assuming you can afford someone that's reasonably good and you hire well, this is where you really start leveraging someone else and freeing up vast quantities of your time. Virtual assistants are a great first step for that, but as soon as you can bring someone in to help with development or to help with, even if you're good at design, to help expedite that and get something done quicker, that's really when I think about bringing contractors on. And consultants I've always brought on where it's like, I have a task and I don't know how to do this, or it's going to take a really, really long time for me to do this, like a huge chunk of my time. Most recently, when I acquired Hittail, I brought a DBA on basically as a consultant to help migrate the database. You know, it was 200-300 gigs to migrate it from one data center to another. We had an overnighting of a hard drive and all types of crazy setup to keep stuff in sync real time. Now, the cool part is that he then came on board on a regular basis to do all the database maintenance and the backups and the point in time restores when I need him to do so. And so he actually made kind of the transition. Now, I still consider him a highly trained expert and experienced consultant, but it's nice that we now have that relationship that I can tap in and say, hey, if, you know, we have this one big thing, can you, I mean, he'll write queries for me sometimes, right? He's just billing hourly, but I'll have a pretty complicated query on a pretty gnarly set of tables that I want to do a join on. And I have him run it through to make sure, you know, is this legitimate? But the thing is if Hittail wasn't a profitable app, I probably wouldn't have dropped the money to bring him on board in the first place. And so I think that's the point. Money shouldn't, you know, it can't be the thing that keeps you from bringing on someone experienced to help leverage your time. But at the same time, you have to be realistic, and you can't just go out and spend $5,000 or $10,000 on a website design when you really should be using that for other marketing tasks.
So now that we've talked about a lot of, I'll call them more temporary workers, why don't we talk about the next one, which is an employee. Bringing an employee into your business, I think, is a huge step. It's a world of difference between having a contractor or a consultant who comes in and does some work for you. And if you don't have any work that you have to send them, or you don't want to send them any work because you're trying to conserve money, then you can totally do that. But with an employee, you're making a lot of commitments, and there's an obligation that you are undertaking in order to pay that person's salary. And you have to be able to meet the revenue targets in order to support that employee. I think one of the big things that most people don't think about when they're hiring an employee is all the additional overhead costs that come in with hiring an employee, because you have to pay employment taxes. You typically have to cover health benefits. There's all these other things, especially when people start to get further advanced in their career and they start thinking about things like, you know, planning for retirement. And they're like, well, do you have a 401k plan or a 529 college savings plan and things like that? And those are things that, you know, kind of add to the overhead of having an employee.
I think the role of employees in tech startups has been changing, and I think it's going to continue to change. Most of the startups that are early stage that are hiring employees, they either have funding or if they're bootstrapped, they just have to be really, really strict about who they hire, and they bring people on slowly. And due to the healthcare costs in the U.S., of the most of like the tech startup workers I know don't have healthcare unless they work for a large company like a Facebook, a Google, someone who has a lot of funding. The mentality of I'm going to work for this startup in exchange for, you know, I'm going to exchange kind of those typical benefits of the 401k and of the medical dental insurance, and I'm going to instead get stock options, and I'm going to get this exciting and fun job. And so I think that puts pressure, you know, a downward age pressure for sure on the startups that I see hiring, in terms of, you know, you can't get, it's going to be really hard to get someone who's 40 years old, married, has two kids to come and work for you if you can't offer all that stuff. But at the same time, you know, if the expense is too overwhelming, then that's probably the reality for them as well.
So the next step up from an employee is a co-founder or a partner in the business. And with a co-founder or partner, most of the time, I think that when you get into this situation, you're doing it upfront. You're probably working on the business on the side until it gets off the ground and starts gaining revenue. And you've hopefully had those conversations about, you know, how to structure things, ownership, vesting, those kinds of things before you start making any real money or you start running into any problems where those discussions that should have been had are going to become a problem because you didn't have them. And, you know, a co-founder and a partner is completely different than having an employee or contractor or a virtual assistant, because they're completely vested into the business, or hopefully vested into the business.
Yeah, didn't Paul Graham say that one of the top two reasons that startups have issues, from what he sees in Y Combinator, is founder issues, founder disagreements?
No, it was in the top 10. I just don't remember what numbers he used for that.
Yeah. So it's, as always, it's like, it's, there's never a never or always, right? Never have a co-founder, always have a co-founder. It's just finding the right person and finding the right fit, both with the business idea and finding complementary skills. I've seen over and over founders get together who are both developers. And that, I just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, it's like you need to find someone who can do the marketing stuff, someone who can do the design stuff, someone who can do the development stuff, someone who can do, you know, the sales and the admin and manage a VA. I mean, there's all these skills that need to get done. And so if you overlap heavily on a single skill, you really are not multiplying your gene pool there and covering the bases that need to get done in order to actually launch something.
Right, but I think that there's another side that you have to look at as well. I mean, if you don't have overlapping skills, it's very difficult to take over responsibilities from somebody else. I mean, and so, if you get a marketing guy together with a developer, they may work very well together by separating their duties, but what happens if the marketing guy needs help or the developer needs help? I mean, at that point, then you have to start looking outside of those two people, because the other person just does not have the capability. I think there's got to be enough of an overlap, but not too much, as you said.
I think I would err on the side of having less overlap.
So, okay, so we've talked about interns and virtual assistants, contractors and consultants, employees and co-founders. And I think the last one that we came up with was an advisor. And I think there's a couple of different ways that you can have an advisor. You can have an advisor who is a strictly high-level person, somebody who you go to and just talk to as more of a mentor. And then I think that there's other advisors who you look at, somebody who owns their own business, who is also an entrepreneur, kind of more of a peer than an advisor who has, you know, run their own company in the past.
I've seen this structured in many different ways. I mean, with funded companies, often someone will bring on an advisor early, and then they'll actually give the advisor 0.5% or 1% of the company, and they'll have, it's a contract. I don't know if they put it in writing, but they'll say, you know, I expect that we'll have a 1-hour phone call each month and that you'll answer my emails every week. I've also seen some informal relationships where you just say, hey, will you answer my emails, or can we do a call when needed? And you're just kind of doing it to help the person out. You probably have a relationship with them of some kind, or you just know that they're going places. So you want to be a part of that. And then, like you said, I've seen mastermind groups where, like you said, it's more of peers giving each other advice and encouragement and help. And I would encourage you that if you are going to get into a mastermind, to try to find people who are ahead of you in that process rather than someone who is either behind you or at the exact same level, because it's just, it winds up being hard to actually get actionable advice if you're all just stumbling around kind of doing the same things, you know. Whereas if someone's 6 months or a year ahead of you, then it tends to be pretty fresh in their mind, and they're going to tend to have some really good suggestions for when you hit roadblocks.
I was reading something recently that heavily advocated for if you're going to be giving any part of ownership of your company, any equity at all to an advisor, then you should definitely have a written contract and a vesting schedule that goes with it. Because some advisors just simply don't work out.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I mean, I would say anytime you're giving anyone equity for any purpose, unless it's a tiny, tiny amount of equity for a very specific task they're doing, that they should vest over time. Because otherwise, you can sign this agreement, and then now they own this thing. And if they disappear, they still own that part. And that's a major problem. So I have a question, Mike. So should everyone have an advisor? Do I need to go seek someone out? And if so, how do I do that?
I think if you're having specific issues that you are fully aware are issues that are going on right now that you need assistance with, then I would definitely go talk to somebody. Do you need to have that person come on as a full-blown advisor? No, not necessarily. What I would say is that if you happen to stumble across somebody who you think would make a good advisor, then definitely leverage them and try to use them as an advisor. But I don't know as I would go out and consciously seek an advisor. And the reason for that is that I think that when you start looking at advisors and you're trying to evaluate different people for advisors, I think that it takes your eye off of the product that you're developing or the marketing that you're doing. And it's not to say that having an advisor couldn't help you with some of those things. But at the same time, if you shift your focus from building your products and talking to customers and doing all the things that are associated with building your business, then you're no longer doing that. And you've kind of shifted into, I almost think of it like the situation for companies that are looking for funding. Either they're building the product or they're looking for funding. And if you're looking for funding, it's kind of an all-consuming task, and you're doing that instead of building your product and making a business.
I also think you need some kind of traction with your product before you can basically do a cold intro and find an advisor, because you can't just email someone who's well-known and say, hey, be my advisor, because they get emails like that all the time, and there are too many products out there that they can't possibly advise everyone. And so if you have a network and you actually do know some people who could be advisors, that's one thing, right? And then it's an easy one-shot email. Hey, I've finally decided to launch my app like we've talked about before. Would you, answer a few emails if I send them over the next few months, and start it off informally and then accelerate it if needed? Now, if you just have no contact and it's all cold, then you are going to need something more than that. You're going to need an email that's like, hey, I launched, I have traction, and I have a couple of sticking points right now. I'm looking for an advisor. Could I send you some emails? And that time, at that point, then you actually, like you said, you have something that you're trying to deal with. On the flip side, I've found a lot of value in there being people who on an ongoing basis are kind of almost sharing in my journey, because they know, or they're really sharing in the journey of the product, I'll say, because you don't have to give them reams of background. You don't just say, hey, I have a SaaS app and here's what's happening, because they're probably going to tell you some suggestions that you've already tried. But if they've gone through the journey of the app with you, then they already know what you've tried, what you haven't, and it's just way easier to get that feedback. And that's where I don't have advisors as much as I have the mastermind groups that I've talked about, where people every 2 weeks, I meet with them either via Skype or in person, depending on the group, and they get to hear an update on my app. Even if I don't have a major issue that week, they get to hear where it's going, some things I'm thinking about. I'll always ask for some feedback, but even if there's not a major point of guidance, at least they're now updated. And so in 2 or 3 months, when I do have that major point, they know the history cold, because they've heard it, in real time as it's happened. And that's been my avenue for finding, kind of filling that advisor role with my businesses. If you have a question for us, call us at our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot. It's used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.